Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
That I decided to go work there as the general manager winemaker for Quintessa. And it was also a reunion with Michel Roland, who was consulting for Quintessa at the time. And it was a wonderful, wonderful early reunion, and had a great, great experience working in the vineyards. Again, we brought back the old biodynamics and converted the whole property to biodynamics during that period. Made some wonderful wines. And then in 2007, my first daughter came, Tosca, and I said, you know, I've got to do something different, and I decided that I was going to start our own wine brand.
Yes.
And Augustin Huneus was very supportive of that. You know, our first vintage of wines were made at Quintessa.
Yeah.
And I started consulting that year as well. And Augustin hired me as a consultant. That was my first job. And I took a consulting job at Seven Stones.
Which is a pretty spectacular.
And then Fisher Vineyards, all in that same year. Blackbird as well was in that same year. So very exciting 2007.
Well,
okay.
You know, your career certainly sounds pretty charmed. Everything you're describing is just—it's unique. It gives you such a cross-section of extraordinary experiences, but you also mentioned it was a lot of hard work. You know, being a GM at a large, you know, internationally renowned brand took a lot of time and energy, and you wanted to be a dad. That was important to you.
Yes, yeah. And I think the thing that I've always been focused on wine, and that's my interest, is in making wine and in making vineyards work and growing wine. And to work at a place like Quintessa, where the focus is not so much wine, but is selling wine.
Yes.
And marketing wine.
Yes.
And, you know, other places I had worked had that too, but I was somewhat protected from that.
Yeah.
And to be sort of thrown to the wolves in this way, it was a shock, and I wanted to pull out of that as quickly as I could, and not be a part of that, because it's certainly not my forte. I'm not interested in convincing people to buy my wine. I'm interested in having people try my wine and then finding it for themselves.
I applaud that. And pot wine, I mean, after having such breadth, depth, intensity of experiences, what was it that you wanted to create for your own brand?
Well, my dream was always to have a vineyard of my own. And in 2004, my wife and I bought a property on Mount Veeder. That at the time was 76 acres, and we've since expanded to 215 acres.
Wow.
Of land. There's still only 5 acres of vineyard up there. But one wonderful property, very wild, very wonderful soils for growing grapes, and very unusual soils for the hillsides. You know, a lot of the hillsides and soils of Napa Valley are volcanic soils. And I was looking for something different. I wanted to find sedimentary soils, you know, that were cooler soils, that were not going to make wines that were hot, high alcohol, super extracted. I wanted something with balance, something with depth, something with integrity. And Mount Veeder was the perfect site for that. And we emptied our bank account to buy this property, and then proceeded to plant the vineyards up there.
So it's a very deliberate choice in terms of site.
Yeah, and a little bit of vengeance too. I wanted to make incredible Cabernet Franc that would stun my friends in Saint-Emilion, and I think we've achieved that.
Wow, how gratifying is that?
Yeah, wonderful.
So you planted your own vineyard, of course.
Yes.
Specific clonal selections, like, did you have a really clear idea what you want to put in the ground?
Yeah, I had brought over a lot of clonal material in the early days that mm-hmm. was planted up at Newton, things brought over to John. Those were disseminated to various parts of Napa Valley for mm-hmm. good or bad. I returned to a lot of those selections and used those to plant my own vineyard. But also, in terms of Cabernet Sauvignon that we planted up there, I fell in love with a lot of the what we call the California heirloom mm-hmm. clones like the C clone mm-hmm. 29, clone 30, clone 31, mm-hmm. wonderful older California clones, Martha's Vineyard selection, these. I would think that a lot of these things, and clearly there's some data that supports that, came from illustrious chateau in the 19th century, but became so marked by California that they became part of the local terroir.
So you have Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, and what else do you have planted?
A little tiny bit of Merlot and a little half acre of Viognier.
Ah. Why Viognier?
I have the property, it's kind of shaped like the continent of Europe. Mm. And in the section that's the lowest section of the property goes from about 1,400 feet in altitude to almost 1,600 feet in altitude.
My goodness.
And the lowest section of the property, where Spain and Portugal would be, it was a very cool site, and it's just above a beautiful old growth redwood grove, mm-hmm. and it's very cool, very humid, and one of the people that was helping me to plant the vineyard at the time asked me if I was going to plant mushrooms down there, and I thought initially I was going to plant Syrah down there, mm-hmm. but my neighbors Steve Legere and Carol Meredith already had wonderful Syrah mm-hmm. on Mount Veeder, and Carol had been a professor of mine at Davis, and Steve Legere had hired me for internships when I was an undergrad working for Mondavi Opus One, and so I didn't want to sort of steal their Syrah thunder. And so I needed a white wine in my world, and I planted Viognier.
Wow.
And so we make a Viognier, small amount of Viognier, about 90 cases a year, that's all aged and fermented in terracotta amphora.
Wow. So I know there are a few spots in the valley that use amphora, but not too many.
No.
What inspired that choice? I'm sure with you everything is deliberate, and you know there's a really good reason for everything that you do.
Well, one thing I hate about Viognier is when it can be so rich that it's cloying. And it's just too over the top. And what I love about Viognier is when it's floral, when it's has good acidity when there's no wood there, that you can really smell this wonderful variety that is so distinctive. The honeysuckle, the melon characters, mm-hmm. the wonderful fruit and floral combinations. And so I really wanted to highlight that. And I also wanted to be able to put it in a vessel that would interact with the air outside, that mm-hmm. would evaporate, that would also bring in oxygen. And clay seemed the perfect thing. So we did some trials with some amphora that we get from a producer, Gusmano Manetti, in outside Florence.
Mm-hmm. So you make a Viognier, a Cabernet Franc?
I make a Viognier that's called 20 cubic meters.
Mm-hmm.
And I make a Cabernet Franc, Merlot Cabernet Sauvignon blend that I call Space and Time.
Okay.
And I make a Cabernet Sauvignon dominant wine, generally about 98% Cabernet Sauvignon and mm-hmm. a little bit of Cabernet Franc that's called the Incubo.
So, very interesting titles. Very impactful.
Yeah, it's true.
So, what's the thought behind those?
So, the Incubo is it's an English word that means a spirit that hoards a treasure.
Oh, like an incubator of sorts, or no?
I think that's where the word derives from.
Okay.
But the word incubo in Latin means a nightmare.
Oh, that's
so,
not good.
And I think it's a little bit of both. You know, I was constantly looking for this. When we bought our property, there was a small vineyard planted in front of the house up there, and I called the property I called that little block the Incubo because there was such a spirit about it, and it was when we first started making the wines, they were just so wonderful and had such depth, and you know, these dark inky things, that there was some spirit about it.
That's so cool.
And it seemed to have a kind of mind of its own, this wine. And so that became the Incubo. And Space and Time really refers to my kind of long love with Cabernet Franc and Merlot. It was sort of the first varieties that I fell in love with. Cabernet Franc, just for its sheer aromatic beauty.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it's a very powerful parent of all of the Bordeaux varieties. You know, it's the father of Merlot. It's the father of Cabernet Sauvignon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a variety that performs well on its own. You see the wines of the Loire that are so intriguing.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's such a minor player in Bordeaux, you know, it really is this small area around the border of Saint-Emilion and Pomerol, and a little bit in the city of Saint-Emilion itself
mm-hmm.
that is important
yeah.
And makes such a huge impact on the world. You know, you mentioned Cabernet Franc, and every wine person first thinks of Cheval Blanc.
Yes.
You know, which is a very small, you know, small little production of Cabernet Franc, but
yeah.
so impactful in the wine world. And you look at something like Ozone as well, that's a mm-hmm. high percentage of Cabernet Franc. You know, these small properties that have such impactful wines.
Wow.
And I mean, that's the space.
Yeah.
And the time is Merlot. I mean, it's a variety that I've always loved, and just the lushness of it, and the supple tannins, and the velvety structure of it. It's it's a very sensual wine, and it's also a very unloved wine. You know, I think people if they're given a glass of Merlot blind, they love it, and then when they're told that it's Merlot, they hate it. It's a much misunderstood wine, I think.
Well, how fitting that you would celebrate the two varietals that, like you said, misunderstood and perhaps, you know, are not really embraced, and when they are, not for the right reasons. it's very fitting. And Viognier, 20 cubic meters under, what is up with that title?
20 cubic meters comes from, they speculated at how much gold they thought had been mined in the world, and they came up with this figure of 20 cubic meters, which seemed incredibly small to me. You know, you would go see the King Tut's tomb, and you would think, gosh, there must be so much gold in the world, you know, all of these wonderful things made of gold for this minor Egyptian monarch. But it is that rare an element that it's there's not much of it. And similarly, we have very little Viognier from our property, and it comes out to be this wonderful pale gold color. And I wanted it to sort of carry the same rarity of gold.
Wow. I hear a lot of historical, scientific, well-researched references. Are you an avid reader?
I love to read, yes. Yeah, I love to read. Like crazy. I wish I had more time to read. That'll be my retirement, maybe.
You're also a really good writer. You've written some pieces in the past that I've read that actually inspired me to become a writer. And, you know, it's a really difficult craft, but what you've written about some of your musings on aging wines and other bits and pieces, I thought were very insightful. I'm kind of secretly hoping you'll republish them, so people these days, it's a good example of how to write, number one.
I don't think you can see blushing in a podcast, but I'm blushing.
I feel very thankful, because unfortunately in my profession there's a lot of surface-like things happening, and that makes me sad, because good and especially great writing is so necessary. It's like a national consciousness in many respects, and you did it proud. I mean, I've read and reread your articles many times.
Oh, thank you. Thanks very much.
So I hope that you republish them, if, you know, maybe on your website or some way that we find a way to put it out, because they're just as relevant today as they were then. In fact, probably more so, because so many conversations have been changed and misdirected.
Yeah, funnily enough, after the 2017 fires, I did a Google search about smoke taint, and the first thing that popped up was an article that I wrote about smoke taint in 2008.
There you go. That's evidentiary proof that we need to get that intel back in front of people and have them understand that history repeats. You know, things tend to be cyclical. We're not really reinventing a whole lot as humans. I'm just maybe arrogant enough to think that we control things, but it's not how it works.
I mean, I have never been so convinced of that than in standing in front of the Egyptian hieroglyph for the wine press, which looks exactly like a modern day vertical wine press. Oh. I mean, you would look at it and you would say, okay, that's a wine press. And that's the Egyptian hieroglyph for a wine press.
Wow.
Nothing's changed. The Egyptians had labels on their amphora that had the name of the parcel, the year of in the reign of the king when the wine was produced, where it was from, who the winemaker was. I mean, they read like a contemporary wine label.
Well, it's kind of disturbing and comforting at the same time. It's disturbing because we're so sadly unaware of it. It's comforting because again, you know, everything repeats, and we should really be more humbled by the fact that we're just part of a greater ecosystem. Whether when we become aware of it, I think it brings, you know, that degree of, you know, awareness that makes us appreciate what we have today and try to protect it and care for it and be good stewards, as opposed to trying to impose something on it. Which I think you're a poster child for that. I think that your entire philosophy is built around being, you know, a great steward of the land.
Yeah, I think that's important. I think we did so much in the 20th century and continue to do so much in the 21st century to destroy what we have, mm-hmm. and to destroy the purity of agriculture. And I think it's time we start to listen.
Right. And there's a lot of conversations about organics, biodynamics, sustainability, but I think it's not really coming from a place of actively wanting to change it. It's more like identifying the problem and not necessarily, and speaking of it on a large scale, but not applying it so much on the micro scale, which is what I believe it takes to really be a change catalyst, is to take care of your specific sphere of influence to the best of your ability. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, I think the biggest difference between farming chemically,
yeah,
and farming organically or farming biodynamically is that you just have to be there more. Huh. You have to be in the vineyard more. You have to be observing more.
Yeah,
It's all about being part of the system.
Yeah.
And not being reactionary, but trying to create a system that's going to work harmoniously with nature.
Yeah. Do you think there's more awareness of that in the winemaking community, you know, that kind of in your own mentality, as opposed to like separation of cellar and vineyard?
I would like to think so, but I see less of it. You know, I see winemakers traveling around trying to sell their wine more. I see people spending less time in their vineyards. I see people trying to come up with ways to do things more simply. And take shortcuts, and it's hard work growing grapes, and it's in order to grow great grapes, it needs to be hard work. It needs to be hard observational work. It needs to be hard physical work.
Yeah.
There's no shortcuts.
You know, that is such a simple but such instrumental truth, that there's no cutting corners, that it is, in fact, agriculture, and you're, in fact, farming.
Yeah, and it's, you know, nobody likes the title of farmer these days. I don't know why. It's a very noble title, but nobody likes that. You know, people want to be executives.
That's really unfortunate, because you're right, there's a lot of honor in that title. You know, that kind of bonding stewardship with the land, I think, is as pure as it gets. You can't get that in the office.
Yeah. People want to be celebrities, you know. Have you ever heard the phrase celebrity farmer?
No, that I haven't heard. You know, I often find myself wondering, what is a consumer to do, you know? There's so much information and conversely misinformation floating around. There's more wine being made than ever, and the good news is that there's more good wine being made than ever. But how do they discern fact from fiction? How do they...
I don't know, that's tough. I mean, we're in an era where there's more good wine made than ever before. There's also more artificial wines made now than ever before. You know, people putting stuff in wines that shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
You know, to stop whatever microbiological wonderful thing is going on in your wines, to make the wines more dense, to make the wines more oaky, to make the wines have this flavor and that flavor. I mean, the stuff you can buy to put in your wines, it's unbelievable. I mean, you would be amazed. You know, from mega purple to color your wine, to sweeten your wine, to gum arabic to make it more dense and encapsulate flavor. And I mean, it's onward and upward, concentrating machines. And
it's kind of a Frankenwine situation.
Yes.
That's
And I mean, you know, the normal person, they can't tell the difference between a Frankenwine and a Cabernet Franc made with quality.
Yeah, and yet I'm so hopeful that there's a way somehow to get them to the table, specifically to the table of people like you, who really dedicated their life to purity of flavor and letting the land shine. I haven't come up with a practical solution other than just learning as much as you can, just like you are a lifelong learner. Is adapting that mentality of bothering to know what you drink.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.